today, isn't it? Mrs. Nunez's lab work is due back today. Can you pull her chart? Okay, sleep now, I said, reaching over to pat his shoulder. But after a while, I want you to get up and get dressed. Today or tomorrow, whenever you're feeling up to it.
I feel fine.
Okay, when you're feeling better, I want you to take me to the place where I buried it. I can remember a lot of that night, cleaning up the bathroom and that old black sweater of Mother's, some things like that, but I can't remember the place. He didn't promise. I think he'd forgotten again who I was. We were comically out of synchrony, a family vaudeville routine. Whatever one of us found, the other lost. I received a letter from the school board. It was early April, a long time after I'd stopped my hopeful excursions to the post office box and had given the key back to Emelina. So this letter appeared on my table among the breakfast dishes while I was at school. I saw it the minute I walked in, but tried to ignore it for the longest time. I carefully went around to the other side of the table and dropped a heavy pile of tests and began to grade them, trying not to see it. A predator is a big guy that eats little guys, wrote Ramo. A herbivore is your wussy vegetarian, in other words, lunch meat. She'd wedged it between the coffee cup and a bottle of aspirin. Did she think it would be bad news? I gave in and tore it open. I can't really say what sort of news it was. Surprising news. It was notification that my contract was going to be renewed for the next year. The term wasn't over, but the school board recognized my circumstances as unusual and wanted to give me ample notice. They were eager for me to return in the fall. My temporary teaching certificate could easily be extended, especially if I had intentions of working toward certification. It was a personal letter written on behalf of the entire board and signed by someone I knew of but had never met, a Mr. Leacock. His letter cited my popularity with the students and commended me for my, quote, innovative presentation and spirited development of a relevant curriculum. It didn't mention contraception or Mrs. Josephine Nash or the ozone layer. I wondered how much they really knew. It made me nervous. I kept looking sideways at that word spirited. After knocking myself out to be accepted, I'd finally flown off the handle in a seditious direction and won a gold star. Mr. Leacock wrote, "We are all aware of the difficulties of engaging teenagers in a vital course of academic instruction." Someone apparently felt I'd succeeded in this endeavor. I was going to be named something like Teacher of the Year. Teachers and kids all voted, secret ballot. I was stunned. I stuck the letter into the pocket of my corduroy jumper and went out for a walk. I tramped quickly down the hill past Mr. Pye's green roof and Mrs. Nunez, who sat in a rocker on her front porch, leaning precariously forward out of her chair, trying to nail a fast-moving spider with the rubber tip of her cane. She lifted the cane and stabbed the air sociably as I passed by. I waved back. I wondered about the lab work Doc Homer had mentioned in his delirium. Was she really waiting for someone far away to examine her cells or her blood and pronounce a verdict? Or was this history, a sentence she was already serving? In town, the 4-H Club had set up a display of rabbits and fancy chickens in cages in front of the courthouse. A little county fair was planned for Easter weekend. The rabbits were of an odd-looking breed, but all exactly alike, fancily marked with black-tipped ears and paws and a gorget under the throat, and it occurred to me how much simpler life would be if people were like that, all identically marked. If I were not the wrong breed. I corrected an old habit of thought. Both my parents were born in grace, and their parents before them. Possibly Doc Homer was right. I'd believed otherwise for so long it had become true. I was an outsider not only by belief, but by flesh and bone. Children knelt by the cages and talked to the rabbits in high voices, poking in sprigs of new grass from the courthouse lawn. Some shoppers had strayed over from their errands across the street. Mary Lopez, a middle-aged woman I knew from Stitch and Bitch, waved at me. She was there with her mother, a very short, broad woman with a long black braid down her back. The old woman leaned over the rabbit cages like a child. Mary rested a hand on the back of her mother's neck, a slight gesture that twisted my heart. I turned up the road toward Lloyd's house. I knew he was home, or would be shortly. He was on a fairly regular schedule these days, running the Amtrak to Tucson and back. We stayed in touch. The air had a fresh, muddy edge, the smell of spring. I had several choices of route, and on a whim, I took a less familiar road. I found myself walking through a neighborhood that wanted to pull me into it, the dirt shade of salt cedars, the dogs that barked without getting up. A woman and her husband argued congenially while they picked grapefruits off the tree in their backyard. The fruits rustled solidly into grocery bags while the woman talked in a low, steady voice and the man answered, on and on, a cycle of gentle irritation and love that would never be finished.
Gee, you're pretty. Are you the new school teacher?
I turned around, startled by a man on a moped. I'd never laid eyes on him before, but I was completely charmed by his line. I felt like Miss Kitty in Gunsmoke.
Well, yes, I said.
You want a ride? There's a wicked pair of brindle bulldogs up at the corner. Okay. I gathered my skirt and straddled the back of his bike. We buzzed smoothly uphill past the putative wicked bulldogs, who lay with their manifold chins on their paws.
My son Ricky's in one of your classes. He says you give them a pretty good round.
They give me one, too, I said. He laughed.
You're Doc Homer's girl, aren't you?
That's right. Homer Nolina of the White Trash Nolinas. He married his second cousin for mad love. I'd been lying to strangers all my life, and no wonder. Here was the truth, and it sounded like a B-grade fairy tale. But I wanted to know if Doc Homer was right, if everyone had forgotten.
I never heard that, my driver said. I just heard she was dead.
She's dead, all right, but she was born and grew up right here. You're around the same age I am. You wouldn't remember her, but it's the truth. Her family thought unkindly of my daddy, so they ran off for a while and he put on an attitude. He laughed at that, but said, you oughtn't to talk bad about a man like him. Oh, I know, Doc Homer's inclined to be useful, but I swear it looks to me like he's been running his whole life on vengeful spite.
I got me an old Ford that runs on something like that.
10 seconds later, he let me off at the base of the path up to Lloyd's house. Lloyd was sitting outside, drinking coffee under the huge mesquite that shaded his front yard. He was just out of the shower, wearing only a pair of soft gray sweatpants. His damp hair lay loose on his shoulders. He looked very happy to see me, but also unsurprised. Typical, maddening Lloyd. Jack betrayed excitement in his thumping tail, but Lloyd made no sudden movements. He let me come to him, bend over to kiss him, sit down in the chair beside him. I was oddly conscious of his skill with animals.
You want coffee?
No, thanks. He sat looking at me, smiling, waiting.
Guess what?
I said finally, handing him the letter. He read it, grinning broadly. It doesn't mean anything, I said. I still can't stay.
It does mean something. It means they want you, whether you stay or not. It means you're real good at what you do.
I took the letter back and looked at it. Not at the words, but the object itself. I guess you're right, I said. I don't think anybody ever told me that before. Not in a letter. I guess that's something.
Sure it is.
I was thinking of it just as one more choice I'd have to make. A complication.
Life's a complication.
Sure, I said. Death is probably a piece of cake by comparison. We looked at each other for a while.
So tell me about your day, honey, I finally said.
We both laughed at that.
Another buck in the bank, doll.
Is that it? Do you like driving trains? You never talk about it.
You really want to hear about it? I think so. Okay, yeah, I like driving trains. Today I went out on a dog catch.
Not the Amtrak?
Nope, a special mission.
You had to catch a dog?
A dog catch is when you go out to bring in a train after the crew's died on the main line.
The whole crew died?
I was visited by the unwelcome thought of Fenton Lee and his sheared-off engine after the head-on collision. I knew this couldn't be what Lloyd meant. He smiled. Died on the hours of service law. They'd worked a full 12 hours, but there were holdups somewhere, and they still hadn't gotten to a tie-up point. You can't work more than 12 hours straight because you'd be tired and it would be dangerous. It's federal law. So you just stop where you are and wait for a relief crew.
Good thing airline pilots don't do that, I said.
I bet they go to sleep at the wheel more than we do, too, Lloyd said. So you went out and caught the dog. Me and another engineer and a conductor and a brakeman all deadheaded out to Dragoon to pick up the train. The dead crew came back to Grace in a car.
And you, what, took the train on into Tucson?
Yep.
So what does that mean? What do you do exactly? Is there a steering wheel?
He laughed. No. You adjust throttles, you set brakes, you watch signals. You use your head. Today I had to use my head. I was the lead engineer, and it was a real heavy train, over 10,000 tons. There were two helper engines coupled at the rear of the train.
10,000 tons?
He nodded. A little better than a mile and a half long.
And you're in the front engine, and there's two engines pushing on the back?
Yep. The hard part was topping over Dragoon. That's a real long hill, a long descending grade from Dragoon to the Benson Bridge, and there's a siding you sometimes have to pull into there at 25 miles an hour. But the train is so damn heavy it wants to take off on you down that hill. I've messed up on that hill a bunch of times before. Just between you and me, one time I went flying through there at 60, hoping to God there was nobody coming on the main line. I never could have gotten into the siding track.
I guess there was nobody coming.
No, but today there was, and I got us in safe and sound. Today I did it exactly right.
He smiled at me over his coffee cup.
So tell me about it.
Well, we topped over the hill way below the speed limit, and when I got about half the train over the hill, I set a minimum amount of air brakes.
Then I waited for it to take hold. The brakes take hold all along the train, in every car, front to back, and then I just watched the speedometer keep coming up.
You're still speeding up, even after you've set the brake?
You got 6,000 tons and a mile of train coming down the hill behind you. What do you think it's going to do?
Duck Homer used to pose puzzles like this to Hallie and me to develop our cognitive skills.
I said, but you've also got some odd thousand tons still coming up the hill behind you.
That's right. A little less coming up and a little more coming down every minute. That's the tricky part. That's the Zen of Southern Pacific. I was extremely impressed.
On a normal train, you'd be real leery of setting the brake while half your train's still coming up the hill. The rear would start pulling backward, and you'd break in two.
Oh, I said, so then you'd have two trains.
Then you'd have a nice long vacation without a paycheck.
Oh.
But I had helper engines that could push on me from the back, so I was pretty sure we wouldn't break in two. I radioed my helper engineer back there to keep pushing up the hill at full throttle, that's throttle 8, and then cut it back to throttle 1 when he topped over.
So he was pushing, and you were braking at the same time.
Yep, setting the brake early enough. That was a part I never got before. It kind of goes against what you think's right.
Nobody can just tell you how to do that hill?
No, because every train's different on every hill. Every single run is a brand new job. You have to learn the feel of it.
So you can't necessarily do the same thing next time?
Not exactly the same thing, no. But on this train, the minimum set worked perfect. And then I worked the throttle to maintain 40 miles an hour. I came down the hill through Sybil and Fenner, the last siding before the Benson Bridge. I got a flashing yellow after Sybil, so I knew we'd probably have to go into Fenner. Then we went by a yellow, and then the next signal was a diverging approach, a red over yellow, and I had to be down to 25 at that signal so we could get into the siding. Sure enough, there was a train on the main line headed east. What if you'd been going 60 like last time? He winked. I wouldn't be getting any nice letters telling me how good I am at my job. Seriously, what if you saw a headlight coming at you in the dark? You heard about Fenton Lee then, did you? What would you do? Lloyd looked at me. Jump off. Yeah? Oh, yeah. I did it one time already when I was a fireman. The engineer hit a siding too fast and that sucker looked like it was going off the track. I was out of there like buckshot. I got a big old bruise on my butt and the guys laughed at me because they didn't derail. I don't care. There's things worth risking your life for, but a hunk of metal's not one of them. I watched him drink his coffee. In the hot sun, his hair had dried to its normal glossy animal black. The mesquite leaves cast feathery shadows all over his face and the muscular slope of his chest. The sight of his bare feet stirred me oddly. I badly wanted to take him inside to bed. Well, but you are real good at your job, I said. I'm getting there. I guess I never knew there was so much to it. He set down his cup and crossed his arms. Pretty good for an engine boy, huh? You could have told me more about it. He smiled. Cody, did anybody ever tell you a damn thing you didn't want to know? I stalled, avoiding the question. If I told you I wanted to go to bed with you right now, would you think I only loved you for your mind? His eyes sparkled. I think I could overlook it. That night, I lay in Lloyd's arms and cried. Since the day I spent with Yuta in the attic, wishes and anger had backed up in me, and now they rushed out, rocketing my mind around on a wild track toward emptiness. I told Lloyd about the photographs and unrelated things, old things, like making pies with Yuta Dell. I told him, I have all these memories I couldn't get hold of before, but it doesn't make me feel any better. What kind of memories? Everything. Really, my whole childhood. Most of it, I had no idea was there. And most of it's happy. But Lloyd, it's like the tape broke when I was 15 and my life started over then. The life I'd been living before that was so different. I don't know how to say this, but I just couldn't touch that happiness anymore. I'd changed so much. That was some other little bright-eyed, righteous girl parading around, trying to rescue drowning coyotes and save chickens from the stew pot. A dumb little kid who thought the sun had a smiley face on it. And what happened when she was 15? I withdrew from Lloyd's arms. Had I set him up to ask? I lay looking at the wall, considering whether I could tell him. If I only had 2 more months in grace, it wasn't long enough. I can't explain it, I said. I guess it finally hit me that nobody was going to take care of me. In high school, you were doing a pretty good job of taking care of yourself. That's what it looked like. It probably looks like that now, too. Lloyd took me back onto his shoulder, which felt hard like a cradle board under my head. He stroked my cheek. You still have all the family you grew up with. Hallie's somewhere out there. She'll come back. And Doc's still here. Neither one of them is here. Cody, for everybody that's gone away, there's somebody that's come to you. Emelina thinks you're her long-lost sister. You know what she told me? She wants you there in that little house forever. She said, if I let you leave Grace, she'll bust my butt. She loves you to death. So this is all a conspiracy, I said. Yeah, Emelina bribed me to fall in love with you. He laughed and kissed my hair. Honey, there's not that much money in the world. I didn't wish to be comforted. You can't replace people you love with other people, I said. They're not like old shoes or something. No, but you can trust you're not going to run out of people to love. I don't think I can trust life that far. I lost my mother. You don't know what that's like.
No, I don't.
You don't have any idea what the whole story is, Lloyd. You don't know everybody I've lost. He gathered me into his arms, and we didn't talk anymore, but in my chest I could still feel a small, hard knot of anger, and I held on to it. It was my wings, my exit to safety. Finally, I read all of Hallie's letters. There were half a dozen I'd never opened, the ones that came after. I knew she'd mailed them before she was kidnapped. I could read the postmarks. But I still held the hope that there might be some clue in there that would help bring her back. Once I opened the letters, that hope would be gone. But I was past a certain point now, like Lloyd's train going over the hill. The momentum of wanting to hear Hallie, even for a few minutes, was growing heavier than anything I might have had to lose. More than ever in my life, I needed to ask her what to do, how to live without guarantees, without safety. So I read the letters, and there were no clues. Only the ordinary heartbreaking details of war and rural life and the slow progress of hope. I'd forgotten that her last letter, which I'd read on the trip to Santa Rosalia, was a tirade. I had to get it out and read it again to remember, and the sting was gone. "If I get another letter that mentions saving the world," she'd written, "I am sending you by return mail a letter bomb." Had I really used those words? But I knew I had, more than once. She'd written, "I don't expect to see perfection before I die. What keeps you going isn't some fine destination, but just the road you're on, and the fact that you know how to drive." 2 hours after she'd mailed that, she had written a pained apology that reached me now, a lifetime later. Any one moment could be like this, I thought, a continental divide. "Cody," she wrote, "I'm sorry. I didn't say it right. I'm touchy about being worshipped. I'm afraid of becoming Doc Homer Jr., standing on a monument of charity and handing down my blessings, making sure everybody knows where we all stand. I don't feel like I'm doing that, but it's the thing you fear most that walks beside you all the time. I don't want you, of all people, to see me that way. I'm not saving Nicaragua. I'm doing the only thing I can live with under the circumstances. The circumstances being that in Tucson, I was dying among the garden pests, working with refugees and also subsidizing the war that was killing them. I had to get out. By virtue of our citizenship, we're on one side of this war or the other. I chose sides. And I know that we could lose. I've never seen people suffer so much for an ideal. They're sick to death of the embargo and the war. They could say uncle, vote for something else, just to stop this bludgeoning. And you know what? I don't even consider that. It's not the point. You're thinking of revolution as a great all or nothing. I think of it as one more morning in a muggy cotton field, checking the undersides of leaves to see what's been there, figuring out what to do that won't clear a path for worse problems next week. Right now, that's what I do. You ask why I'm not afraid of loving and losing, and that's my answer. Wars and elections are both too big and too small to matter in the long run. The daily work, that goes on. It adds up. It goes into the ground, into crops, into children's bellies and their bright eyes. Good things don't get lost. Cody, here's what I've decided. The very least you can do in your life is to figure out what you hope for. And the most you can do is live inside that hope. Not admire it from a distance, but live right in it, under its roof. What I want is so simple, I almost can't say it. Elementary kindness. Enough to eat. Enough to go around. The possibility that kids might one day grow up to be neither the destroyers nor the destroyed. That's about it. Right now, I'm living in that hope, running down its hallway and touching the walls on both sides. I can't tell you how good it feels. I wish you knew. I wish you'd stop beating yourself up for being selfish and really be selfish, Cody. You're like a mother or something. I wish you knew how to squander yourself. I sat with this letter for a long time trying to understand what peace she was asking me to make. The others were impersonal, full of description and the usual manic-depressive melange of experience. The weather had been too dry. A shipment of Yugoslav tractors had come in, and they were working out well. The John Deeres were better, she lamented, but you have to run them like glass hammers. They can be dry-docked for lack of a bolt. The U.S. refuses to trade with us and then makes secret, niggling lists of what we get from the Eastern Bloc. The embargo having slipped their minds, apparently. In another letter, she said they heard gunfire almost every night. People talk about the second reconstruction, she said. They mean after the U.S. invades. We get up every day and scan the horizon for Holocaust. In this same letter, she talked about her young trainees and the joy of seeing a new idea take root in a mind. I knew the moment. When Ramo grasped DNA, his countenance was touched with light. We'd shared something. I stayed up most of the night rereading letters, all the way back to the first one from the Guatemalan border, where she saw women running from the army carrying babies and backstrap looms. And earlier, on the beach, where she'd watched a man sell shrimp from a bucket that was counterweighted with a plastic jug of drinking water. He drank as he went along to keep the load balanced. The purity of direct necessity. But the letters ended, finite as a book or a life, and I had no choice but to keep coming back to the last one, scrutinizing it for a sign of goodbye. It wasn't there. It was a description of the children's Christmas Eve pageant, three or four words about Julio, and a self-effacing story of how she'd broken her plate that morning at breakfast. Of course it was a disaster. There was only one anything per person in the house. She was mad at herself for being careless, but the neighbor women rounded up a new plate. They made a joke of its being tin, unbreakable. Nothing else. The closest thing to prescience had come a few days earlier in a pensive, pared-down note that said, "Sometimes I still have American dreams. I mean literally. I see microwave ovens and exercise machines and grocery store shelves with 30 brands of shampoo, and I look at these things oddly in my dream. I stand and I think, what is all this for? What is the hunger that drives this need? I think it's fear. Cody, I hope you won't be hurt by this, but I don't think I'll ever be going back. I don't think I can." I had my own nightmare again, but this time I understood that it wasn't blindness. It was a flashbulb in my father's camera. Even from inside the dream, I knew that, and I didn't wake myself when I heard the glass pop. I took the risk of staying where I was and went on dreaming. What I saw next was an infant face that wasn't my own, but my child's, lit in the flash. Then I saw her whole body in moonlight. She was a 17-year-old girl, naked and long-limbed, walking up the path toward our house. I stood in the kitchen and watched her through the screen door as she came up the path from the river. For a second, she disappeared in the inky shadows under the cottonwoods, and I felt completely afraid. But then she emerged again in the light. Her skin glowed white. I thought, if she tries to walk through this screen door into Doc Homer's kitchen, she'll evaporate. She can't come in here. So I ran outside and gathered her up, a ridiculous bundle of long arms and legs. I carried her back through the cottonwood grove and down the path, away from the house. Over our heads was a chalky full moon with cloud rubbed across it, like something incompletely erased. I was hunched over and stumbling, and I started to run along the dry riverbed, absurdly burdened with this long-legged child as big as myself. I didn't talk or look at her. I just carried her along. Hallie followed me down the path. I didn't see her come, but I heard her voice right behind me. "Cody, stop. She's too heavy. You can put her down now." I clamped her weight against my chest. "No, I can't. She'll fall." "Let her go. She won't fall." "I can't." Hallie urged gently, "Let her go. Let go. She'll rise." And then I woke up with empty arms. Chapter 24, The Luckiest Person Alive. The call came sometime before dawn. While I brushed my teeth, I watched the mirror closely and became aware of my skull, of the fact that my teeth were rooted in bone and that my jaw bones and all the other bones lay just under the surface of what I could see. I wondered how I could have missed noticing before, all those bones. I was a skeleton with flesh and clothes and thoughts. We believe there is such safe distance between the living and the dead. I recalled how I'd used Mrs. Josephine Nash to shock my students into paying attention on the first day of school. I'd thought I understood something they didn't about death, that it was understandable. I was still at the mirror when Lloyd came. I saw him appear behind me. First he wasn't there, and then he was. He was going to drive me to Tucson. I had to go to the Mexican consulate and get a registered letter and some papers, and then I would sign some other papers from the Nicaraguan government. Of course, there was no Nicaraguan consulate. It was the Minister of Agriculture who called. We had become something like friends, though we would probably not speak again now. Or perhaps we would. I'd heard of people united by disaster, keeping track for years afterward, holding reunions. I thought of boat people, business executives stranded overnight in elevators. How would they celebrate? What specific moments would they recall for each other? My thoughts kept straying onto random paths like these, hoping to get lost in a thicket. The minister said there would be a package coming later. Not her body, but a parcel of personal things, some books and journals. Her plate and cup, her clothes, those items were distributed to neighbors. The body would stay there. She had requested of somebody, at some point, that she be buried in Nicaragua, if that ever had to happen. She said Nicaragua could use the fertilizer. "What was the last thing she said to me in person? How did she look? Why can't I remember?" "Lloyd," the face in the mirror said, "what do I do now?" "Put on your shoes." "Okay." The sun was just coming up as we drove away from Grace. The world looked inhospitable. "I should have gone down there," I said. "And done what?" We drove past an old junkyard outside of town. I'd never noticed it before, though it must have been there since before I was born. A man stood on the bonnet of a rusted car, shading his eyes, looking down into the ravine. "On the phone they said her hands were tied," I told Lloyd. He said they found her that way, but I can't believe that. It doesn't sound right to me that she would let anybody just tie her up and then shoot her in the head. "Maybe they made a mistake," he said. "Maybe it didn't happen exactly that way." "I know my sister. I think she would get away somehow," I said. "Wait for the letter. That'll tell everything." "Maybe they made a mistake," I repeated. "Maybe so." Within an hour, the daylight had overcome its early bleakness. Now it looked like any normal, slightly overcast day. The normalcy made me angry, but it was a weak kind of anger that held no pleasure. If I'd told her about Doc Homer back in December, how bad he was, she would have come home. You can't make this your fault. But she would have come home. Cody, Lloyd said, looking at me and not finishing. His face held such pain I didn't want to see it. Finally, he said, you could probably think of 100 little things that would have made this turn out different, but you'd be wrong. A life like your sister's isn't some little pony you can turn around any way you want. It's a train. Once it gets going, it's heavier than heaven and hell put together, and it runs on its own track. I didn't say anything to that. Lloyd barely even remembered meeting my sister. How could he know what her life meant? On the interstate, we passed the site of a bad accident. You could see it coming, the cop cars and ambulances all huddled around, lights flashing importantly, making their scene. As we came closer, we had to slow down. One lane was blocked by a trailer rig with a smashed front end. Out in the median, at an angle that bore no relation to the direction of traffic, sat a white convertible with its frame bent violently into a V-shape. When we passed it, I saw that it wasn't a convertible after all. The top had been sheared off and lay on the other side of the road. An arc of glass and chrome crossed the highway like a glittering river littered with flotsam and jetsam, a pair of sunglasses, a bright vinyl bag, a paperback book. At the trail's end was the pile of steel. I'd never seen such a badly wrecked car. Doesn't look like anybody walked away from that one, Lloyd said. I thought of Hallie walking out of the library that time, years ago, then remembering her sunglasses and turning back just before the marble facade fell down. She could just as well have died then. It made no difference now. The luckiest person alive. The ambulance pulled out right behind us, its warning lights alternating like crazy winking eyes. We quickly left it behind, though, and we weren't speeding by any means. Lloyd saw me watching the ambulance and glanced up at the rearview mirror. They're not in much of a rush, are they? Just then, while we watched, the lights stopped flashing. I understood that I had just seen someone die. No reason to hurry anymore. My limbs flooded with despair, and I didn't see how I was going to survive. I kept imagining what that little white car must have looked like half an hour ago, and the driver, some young woman listening to the radio, checking her hair in the mirror, preoccupied with this afternoon or tonight or whatever small errand had taken her out. Why does a person even get up in the morning? I asked Lloyd. You have breakfast, you floss your teeth so you'll have healthy gums in your old age, and then you get in your car and drive down I-10 and die. Life is so stupid, I can't stand it. Hallie knew exactly what she was doing, Cody. There wasn't anything stupid about her life. I practically shouted at Lloyd, I'm not crying about Hallie right now. I'm crying about that person that just died in the ambulance. He was quiet. Lloyd, I don't know what I'm going to do. I was afraid the muscles in my chest might tear themselves apart. I thought senselessly of Doc Homer's discussion of liver tissue and heart tissue, as if it mattered what part of your body was the seat of emotion. All of it could be torn up. It was just flesh. Doc Homer didn't even know about this yet. I'd called, and we talked, and it was clear he didn't know what I was telling him. He talked about Hallie being kept after school. Maybe he never would understand. Maybe his mind would just keep wandering down other happy trails. Lloyd handed me his handkerchief, and I tried to blow my nose. What would she want you to do? She would be crying for a person in a damn ambulance that she didn't even know. Not me. I saw lightning erupt in the dark clouds behind the Catalina Mountains. It was an impossible time of year for a lightning storm. I'd seen photographs of lightning frozen in its terrible splendor, ripping like a knife down the curtains of the sky. They say that to take those pictures, you just open your camera on a dark night in a storm, and if you're lucky, you get a wonderful picture, you have no control. Hallie isn't dead, I said. This is a dream. I laid my head back against the headrest and cried with my knuckle bones against my mouth. Tears ran down to my collarbone and soaked my shirt, and still I didn't wake up. Chapter 25. Flight. Getting on the bus was the easiest thing in the world. I only took what I could carry. Emelina would send my trunk to Telluride. I noticed the junkyard again on the way out of town. They should have had a sign there, "Welcome to Grace, farewell to Grace." Dead grass poked up through the rusted husks of big old cars that hunched on the ground like elephants, the great dying beasts of the African plain. It was early June, soon after the end of school. The land was matchstick dry, and I felt the same way, just that brittle, as if no amount of rain could saturate my outer layers and touch my core. I was a hard seed beyond germination. I would do fine in Telluride. Carlo had lined up a job for me as a model in a summer fine arts school. I would sit still for solid hours while people tried for my skin tones. Yuta Dell and Mrs. Quintana, Doc's assistant for 21 years, were going to take shifts with Doc Homer. His office was closed for good, and everybody now drove over to New Mexico to be healed. There were no thunderclaps when it happened. All this time we'd thought he was indispensable. Yuta and Mrs. Quintana revered him. I couldn't picture them feeding him, buttoning up his shirt, but I knew they would do those things. Somehow, reverence can fashion itself into kindness in a way that love sometimes can't. When I went up there to tell him goodbye, he was eating a soft-boiled egg and said he couldn't tarry, he was in a hurry to get to the hospital. I bobbed along with the motion of the Greyhound bus, leaning with the curves. When I relaxed enough, I could feel like a small chunk of rock in outer space, perceiving no gravitational pull from any direction. Not from where I was going, nor where I had been. Not Carlo, not Lloyd, not Doc Homer, not Hallie, who did not exist. "Where do you think people go when they die?" Lloyd asked the day before I left. He was on his way out to take a westbound into Tucson. The next day he would fetch home the Amtrak. We stood in my front door, unwilling to go in or out, like awkward beginners trying to end a date. Except it wasn't a beginner's conversation. "Nowhere," I said. "I think when people die, they're just dead." "Not heaven?" I looked up at the sky. It looked quite empty. "No." "The Pueblo story is that everybody started out underground. People and animals, everything. And then the badger dug a hole and let everybody out. They climbed out the hole, and from then on they lived on top of the ground. When they die, they go back under." I thought of the kivas, the ladders, and the thousand mud walls of Santa Rosalia. I could hear the dry rattle of the corn dancers' shell bells, the exact sound of locusts rising up from the grass. I understood that Lloyd was one of the most blessed people I knew. "I always try to think of it that way," he said after a minute. "He had a big adventure up here and then went home." Leander, he would mean. My spleen started to ache when I thought of Hallie fertilizing the tropics. Thinking about how much she loved stupid banana trees and orchids. I said, "I have this idea that if I don't stay here and cry for Hallie, then there's no family to absorb the loss. Nobody that remembers."
"And that's what you want? For Hallie to be forgotten?"
I couldn't have said what I meant.
"No, I just don't want to be the one that's left behind to hurt this much. I want to be gone already. If you're dead when somebody stabs you, you don't feel it."
"Leaving won't make you dead. You'll just be alive in a different place."
"This place has Hallie in it. When I lived here, I was half her and half me."
Going away won't change how you feel.
I won't know that till I'm gone, will I?
He picked up my hand and examined it as if it were a foreign object, which was just how it looked to me. He was wearing a green corduroy shirt with the sleeves rolled to the elbows, and I felt I could look at that shirt for as long as Lloyd might choose to stand in my door. There were all those small ridges, that greenness, the nap of the cloth. If I kept my focus minute enough, I could remain in the world, knowledgeable and serene.
Anyway, you're wrong, he said. There's family here to absorb the loss.
Doc Homer, Lloyd, I don't think he understands she's gone.
I wasn't talking about Doc Homer.
I shifted my field of vision to include the lower part of Lloyd's face and the blunt, dark ends of his hair. A whole person seemed an impossible thing to take in all at once. How had I lived so long and presumed so much? I said, I'm sorry about everything, Lloyd.
Listen, I know how this is. You don't think you'll live past it, and you don't, really. The person you were is gone, but the half of you that's still alive wakes up one day and takes over again.
Why should I look forward to that? He turned my hand over.
I can't answer that.
Well, I'm sorry, Lloyd.
I'm sorry, too.
Well, you've got to go to work. I avoided his eyes. Lloyd took my face in one hand and put the other hand on the small of my back, and he kissed me for a long time. His mouth felt cool as green corduroy, a simple thing I could understand. We began the kiss standing up, and when we finished, we were sitting on the step. You have to go, I said. That was the last thing, my last words for Lloyd. When he and Jack were gone, I stood for a long time looking out at the rambling jungle of the courtyard. A hummingbird, possibly the same one that had inspired Nicholas to learn to walk, was hovering at the red funnels of the trumpet vine climbing my wall. I watched the bird move stiffly up and down over an invisible path, pausing, then moving left, then up again and back, covering the vertical plane with such purpose it might have been following a map. I felt Emelina's presence. She stood in her kitchen door, shading her eyes, watching me. I waved, but she didn't wave back. Her face was drawn tight with mute, unarmed rage. It must have been the worst thing she was capable of aiming at a friend. She didn't know my tricks, that you could just buckle up your tough old heart and hit the road. My course must have been as indecipherable to her as the hummingbird's. We are all just here, Emelina, I wanted to say, following our maps, surviving as we know how. The kitchen door closed quietly, and I understood that it was her kindest goodbye. The sun was strangely bright on the whitewashed wall, and the hummingbird hung in the air, frozen inside its moment, a photograph of the present tense. All morning, on my last day, people came pecking softly at my door like mice. A legion of mice bearing gifts. It was mostly women from the Stitch and Bitch. No one else was as succinct as Emelina. They wanted to know what I would be doing, where I would live. I mentioned the art school, but I wasn't specific.
We sure do love you, hon, said Yuta Dell. I packed you a lunch. There's yellow banana peppers in there from the garden. They're not as big as some years, but they got a right smart bite. Stay another year, she added.
Do you have a good winter coat? Norma Galvez asked me.
It snows up there. You'd just as well stay here.
In their eyes, my life should have been simple, purely a matter of love and the right wardrobe. It was as if I had 50 mothers. In the last hour before I left, I had to go through Emelina's kitchen to retrieve a pair of jeans from the laundry room. John Tucker was folding laundry. He told me Emelina was lying down upstairs with a bad headache.
You got a baseball game today? I asked.
Yeah.
Sorry I won't be around to see you win.
He smiled. In a year, I'd watched him grow into his elbows and lose the better part of his shyness.
His voice was beginning to crack.
Mom's really gonna miss you. She'll be a witch for the next month. She'll make us clean out the chicken pens and stuff.
It's all my fault, I said, grabbing a runaway corner of a sheet and helping him fold it. You guys can send me hate mail and Telluride. He laughed. Okay. If it gets too bad, you can run away from home. Come up and see me. We'll go skiing.
He hoisted his laundry basket and headed for the stairs. When I came back out through the kitchen, Viola was there at the table, lying in wait like a predator.
Sit down, she said. Save your shoes.
I was lunch meat. I sat down.
Boy, oh boy, kiddo, she said.
What does that mean, that I should stay here?
Sure you should.
Well, I said.
But nobody could ever tell you a darn thing.
That's what I hear.
I've been wanting to tell you something.
I know Emelina's pissed off at me.
She snorted. If you don't know that already, you're not going to hear it from me.
Oh, I thought about what else she might have to reveal to me. I know about my mother, I said. I know she came from here, that she was a cousin or something to Doña Altea, and that she and Doc Comer ran off.
Viola smiled a little.
Son of a gun, he told you?
More or less. She adjusted the coil of hair on the back of her head, reclaiming its territory with the planting of a few long bobby pins.
Well, that's not what I was wanting to tell you.
We sat looking at each other for a good long while. Her t-shirt said I was deep-dished at Mama Leonarda's. I had no idea where it might have come from.
I'm not supposed to tell you, she added.
Says who?
Says me. Doc Comer would shoot me if he found out.
I don't think there's much danger, Viola.
Well, but it's the principles.
Now I was curious.
So, did you sit me down here to tell me something or not?
She hesitated, shifting her weight forward onto her elbows on the table.
I was looking after you girls the day your mama died.
You kept us at home? She nodded.
I was supposed to.
But you didn't.
I thought you had the right to say bye to your mama like anybody else, to tell her vaya con Dios. Anybody else had no business up there. They just went to watch the show. But you had business, and you was not allowed to go. Hallie was just born. She didn't know anything anyway, so I left her with you to Dell.
And you took me up to the field to see the helicopter come down?
Viola leaned back in her chair.
I'm not saying I did, and I'm not saying I didn't.
What are you saying?
Just that you had a right, that's all. Now, skedaddle, que la vaya bien.
The Greyhound was mostly empty, a dry gourd rolling across the desert, occasionally spilling out a seed or two in an inhospitable outpost. Bowie, Wilcox, Benson. It was 110 degrees down there, not something people would travel through unless they were desperate to be elsewhere. As things had turned out, Grace was not going to dry up. The women of the Stitchin' Bitch had won back the river. A vice president of the Black Mountain Mining Company called a press conference in Phoenix to announce that after 70 years of productive and congenial relations with the people of Grassela Canyon, the mine operation there was closing up shop. It was a matter of the leaching operations being no longer profitable, he said. The dam would be deconstructed. Naturally, if any harm had been incurred, all necessary reparations would be made to the people of Grace. He made no mention of the historic registry petition that had been filed 1 week earlier. So mountains could be moved. Now I knew. When my bus paused in Wilcox, a woman climbed aboard and chose to sit by me, rather than take her chances on something worse that might come along, I guess. She wore an ample white jogging suit and had an odd metallic hair color. I spent the next 50 miles in fear of a conversation I wasn't in the mood for, but she just kept scowling at a gardening magazine. Then suddenly she held out her magazine as if it had offended her.
That kills me how people can grow 4 o'clocks like that, she said, whacking the page with the back of her plump hand. I glanced over at the unbelievable floral displays in her magazine. I could relate to her frustration. You just knew they trucked in those flowers from a climate-controlled greenhouse somewhere and arranged them on the lawn right before snapping the photo. "I'm Alice Kimball," the woman explained. "I get the worst slugs." Alice, would my mother be wearing tepid jogging suits now if her organs had not failed her? I tried to smile.
"Where do you get them?"
"In my 4 o'clocks. That's what I'm trying to tell you. I can't grow a 4 o'clock to save my life. The leaves get so full of holes, they just look pitiful. And they get in the lawn, too. My husband says he hears them out there eating up his grass. What can you do?"
"I'm not the right person to ask," I said. "My sister could sure tell you, though. She got a degree in integrated pest management. She used to answer the garden hotline in Tucson, 626-BUGS.
Mrs. Kimball brightened as if I'd offered her a peppermint. "I've called that before. They have the nicest little girl on that line. She'll tell you anything you want to know."
"That was my sister you talked to.
Hallie Nolene." I was amazed by the coincidence. But then again, probably half of Tucson had turned to Hallie for advice. And half of Nicaragua.
"That was part of her job," I said. "She did that for 6 years.
Mrs. Kimball looked around at the neighboring seats as if Hallie might turn up for consultation.
"What do you mean she's quit? I just thought the world of her."
"Yep, she quit. She left the country."
"Left the country?"
"She went to Nicaragua."
Everybody in this country should know her name, I thought.
During the Iran hostage crisis, they had a special symbol on the newscasts, a blindfolded man and the number of days. A schoolchild glancing up from a comic book would know that the story was about them. But a nation gloats on the hostility of its enemies, whereas Hallie had proved the malevolence of some men we supplied with machine guns. Hallie was a skeleton in the civic closet. Some people knew. I'd gotten a card from a nun in Minneapolis who had known Hallie. She was one of several thousand people who had gone down to Nicaragua for just a week or two, she said. They helped pick coffee, or if they had training, they did other helpful things. The idea was just to be there in the danger zone, so if the U.S. should attack, it would have to attack some of its own citizens. This nun, Sister Sabina Martin, had helped give vaccinations. She met Hallie at the clinic in Chinandega the day Hallie brought in a child who'd drunk paraquat from a Coke bottle. Sister Martin and Hallie sat with the child the whole day, and she said that although I might not think it possible, she felt she'd come to know Hallie well during that time. In some circumstances, she said, an afternoon can be a whole life.
"Oh, well," Mrs. Kimball said after quite a while, "you must miss her."
"I will, when it really sinks in. She hasn't been gone that long."
"I know what you're going through," said Mrs. Kimball. "I lost my sister in 1965.
I hadn't told her Hallie was dead. Mrs. Kimball had seized the subject of death all on her own.
"I'm sorry," I said, not really wanting to be encouraging, but you couldn't just ignore it either. "She's been dead all this time of an aneurysm, and there are still days when I think, oh, wait till I tell Phoebe about that, before I realize. I always think it's harder to believe they're gone when it's sudden."
"My sister," I said, and then stopped, afraid of the lie I was about to tell. I was going to say, "isn't dead." I heard an old voice in my head, the teller of tales. "I am a cello player running away from home. We are from Zanzibar. We're from Ireland. Our mother is the queen of potatoes." I was through constructing myself for other people. I didn't say anything. Several seats ahead of us, a teenage couple had begun necking enthusiastically. You couldn't blame these kids. The scenery was boring and would drive you to anything, but they made me feel hopelessly alone.
"Well," Alice said, apparently remembering it was garden pests we'd agreed to talk about. "What would you do for the slugs?"
"I really don't know. I'm not that good with plants." I considered the problem for a while. I think what Hallie used to do was put out beer for them in little tin cans. The slugs are attracted to it and they fall in or something. I know that sounds crazy, but I'm pretty sure it's right. Well, she stared at